Good morning. My name is Michael McCusker. If you thought this past Monday was Columbus Day, you have been deceived. The parades, the president's officially insipid proclamation were fake and superficial. The real, bona fide Columbus Day is tomorrow, Friday, October 12th, 1492, the day the Admiral of the Ocean Sea and his three little ships came upon a wall of Caribbean islands. I start today's program with something I wrote about that immortal clash of consequences. I call it Hello, Columbus. 526 years ago, on Friday, October 12th, 1492, a Genoa mariner stumbled onto the Western Hemisphere while seeking passage to the Far East. One world was born that day, but the world that was here began that instant to die. Christopher Columbus missed his mark by half a world, and by that doubled the world's size. The old civilizations of Europe sent their most favored and dumped their least palatable on the shores of the New World, though they were equals in their fervent obliteration of the worlds they found, and they turned on each other as well. 200 years later, the great thinkers of the 18th century Enlightenment debated the consequences of the European discovery of the American continents and concluded the costs had been too high for the gains. The great thinkers wished the great navigator had never set sail or had perished with his three small ships on the ocean, though someone would have claimed discovery of the New World eventually, and many had made landfalls in the same hemisphere from both Atlantic and Pacific oceans hundreds, even thousands of years earlier. And Columbus might himself have wished he never set sail either. He died poor and in disgrace. Unknown at first to the Europeans who sought wealth and souls with murder and torture of the primitive tribes they initially encountered, were great civilizations as autocratic, expansive, and cruel as their own. A few matched and even exceeded the European cultures that were themselves just recovering from a prolonged reversion. A renaissance of Western civilization, a rebirth of lost classical knowledge, culminated in the calamitous error of Columbus, who refused to believe that he had blundered upon an entirely unknown landmass that blocked his passage to the ancient East. And immediately, Columbus began the cruel harvest of native inhabitants that was to last for at least four centuries. As the natives perished by the millions from slaughter, forced labor, disease, and despair, half of Africa, it seemed, was emptied to provide slaves for New World plantations and mines, and millions died before ever reaching the Americas. New civilizations spawned upon the ruins of the obliterated, often deeply influenced by them, and one in particular emerged from seeds of radical ideas brought across the Atlantic from nations that spurned them into exile. This new society was uncomfortably germinated by various peoples who had come to stay, some as seekers, others as slaves, and its government was founded on the heretical proposition that people should be free and equally rulers of the state. The ideal was always in conflict with reality. At times, the tension created brilliant advances in civil liberties. Most of the time, progress was slow, bloody, and often as not retrogressive. The major contradictions of the nascent republic were its long acceptance of slavery and the remorseless extermination of native cultures and ethnic cleansing repeated in other places in more recent times. The annual observance of Columbus's first voyage to the Americas, named after a later Italian explorer who was not fooled into believing he had reached Asia, is heated and controversial. Some celebrate, others bitterly denounce the intrusion of Europe upon the Western Hemisphere and half a millennium of conquest, epidemic, and cultural genocide. Words of placation or condemnation are exchanged. The old world invaded, encountered, conquered, converged with the new, depending on the perspectives of the speakers. However one might feel, Columbus and his successors are as inescapable a fact of history as a jumbo meteor that quite likely impacted Earth and ended the long age of dinosaurs. Columbus's voyage began the end of the long seclusion of descendants of Stone Age Asian hunters who had crossed over in periods when the Bering Sea was shallow and the continents were connected at their northern extremities and were subsequently cut off from the rest of the human world when the waters rose again as ice ages melted. The ancient cycles of pre-Columbian civilizations disappeared under the onslaught of invaders who were oblivious of them. In the same manner, sometime in the future, the civilizations that have grown from their ruins will be devoured, deteriorate, or self-destruct. And in the words of Lafcadio Hearn, who favored the resurgence of Asia over the West, post-Columbian cultures, quote, will be as mist as the ichthyosaur. And that was Hello, Columbus. And sort of as an addendum, recently, as a rather ironic historical twist, Native American tribes have offered their remaining reservation lands as sanctuaries in the latest white American nativist oppression and purge against non-white and Muslim immigrants. And now, to follow the latest trajectory of post-Columbus American civilization, in particular that of the United States, Democracy for All, which I have also written. Democracy begins at home, first in the heart. From there, it radiates through the house into the neighborhood and community. It is found in smaller places rather than in massive, standardized illusions of popular culture that reflect mind manipulation and mendacity, as well as gross distortions of constitutional purposes and interpretations. Democracy is, after all, a compromise between the yearning for freedom and the urge to frustrate it. It is an elaborate, though inherently fragile, system of concessions between diverse and disparate ambitions and ideologies represented by a variety of economic and political classes, despite an enshrined myth that democracy is a classless society. The only possible survival for democracy is to establish and sustain balance between conflicting factions so that none gain such power as to be capable of suppressing or ravaging the rest. In that sense, no debate or problem can be fully or finally resolved without its solution becoming repressive. The true extent of the variety and depth of American politics was cogently expressed by Edwin O'Connor in his famous 1956 book, The Last Hurrah. Quote, each campaign expedition through the voting public was aimed at a special group of the electorate. What was astonishing was not that such special groups existed, but that they existed in such numbers. They were divided not only along the broad lines one might have anticipated, race, religion, national background, sex, capital, and labor. Inside whichever category one chose, it seemed there were limitless special cells, each of whose concerns seemed to be in direct opposition to every other cell. A staggering multiplicity of minority interests. A chaotic diversity of the democratic process. And that was Edwin O'Connor. Diversity is democracy, and vice versa. Unfortunately, the USA is rapidly retrogressing from a diversely constructed democracy centered on the theoretical rule of common folk to an aristoplutocracy of billionaires and immense multinational corporations. The nation is at a crossroads as severe and consequential as the Civil War, a crisis that will determine its future as a democracy, either as a corporate and upper-class oligarchy administered by questionably elected stooges, or an open society as envisioned in its most fundamental beliefs and laws, as well as a leading member of a world confederacy of presumably eventual democracies. Periods of national crises reveal the impotence of average citizens whose marginal influence with elected representatives is deflected by powerful elites who more often than not precipitate the crises. Civil liberties are dramatically threatened, and the common citizenry has little to say that arouses official consciousness. Ordinary people are rendered impotent. Most citizens are at the bottom of the crisis and are affected every day by the consequences. Social services are withdrawn as well as public health because tax money is diverted to the elites and corporations whose own taxes are slashed. Public dissent is inhibited, treated as unpatriotic, and possibly a form of terrorism. Huey Long, who had personal aspirations as a populist tyrant, said, "Fascism will come to the United States wrapped in the American flag." The prospect of the decline of civil liberties exacerbates the malign neglect of the huge and growing underclass that wretchedly subsists, virtually abandoned and homeless, on the fringes of cities and impoverished rural areas. Surging disparities in wealth and standards of living that undermine our society and forebode massive civil disorder are also the death knell of real democracy. Ambrose Bierce, in his classic The Devil's Dictionary, cynically but pertinently defined politics as a strife of interests masquerading as a contest of principles. We in our small cities and towns on the Oregon coast are vulnerable to the erosion and circumvention of constitutional rights and liberties. A city like Astoria, at the mouth of the Columbia River, named after a ship, named after the great navigator himself, Columbia Redivivva, is a small community that represents American cities and towns everywhere in the country, which means Astoria, as should every community, have the right and perseverance to help guide the nation's policies rather than simply allow loftier echelons of government determine its present and future without the input of those most directly affected. The societal ceiling is cracking over our heads, and it is up to us, common, ordinary citizens who live in neighborhoods and communities, who are ultimately responsible to prevent the sky from falling down around us. Individual voices are not nearly enough. They are lost, diluted, neglected, certainly diffused. Only through groups, associations, and political parties is there any sense of personal influence. Yet, with each successive level, even that is diluted and essentially marginalized to evaporation. A level to reflect the personal voice must be closer to home, a community voice that reflects and echoes beyond community. Cities and communities are not simply parochial entities concerned with schools, sewers, streets, and strip malls. They are also integral parts of a cultural and political whole and represent, at a rudimentary, essential level, the American citizen at home and work. Cities such as Astoria, Seaside, Tillamook, Newport, Coos Bay, Port Orford, Gold Beach, and Brookings must be actively engaged in the critical and urgent national dialogue of democracy versus tyranny, domestic terrorism versus justice and law, and the dangerous abrogation of civil liberties by fanciful claims for dictatorship rather than imperfect constitutional governance that attempts to guarantee liberty and equal justice for all. Astoria certainly has a myriad of local issues and problems that demand attention and resolution, but they are secondary to the current assault upon the nation's fundamental freedoms and constitutional rights by avaricious national leaders transgressing their sworn duty to uphold them. It is vital the small communities question and influence state and national policies that ultimately affect the lives, liberties, and fortunes of their citizens. As everybody knows, all politics are local. And that was something I wrote, Democracy for All. And as you must be aware, October is Domestic Abuse Awareness Month. And it is also the 39th anniversary of the original Clatsop County Women's Crisis Service. So today I read an article by Vicki Swanson Garmo, which is aptly relevant since the latest U.S. Supreme Court kerfuffle, The Anger of Women. Starts with a quote by Muriel Rukeyser. What would happen if one woman told the truth about her life? The world would split open. I want to address the anger of women, all of whom are involuntary inductees at birth into the oldest and longest of wars that waged around the issue of sexism. It is an undeclared war. As in all wars, there is no real winner. There is only a victor who must constantly guard himself and his position by continuous aggression on the various fronts and behind the lines. It is a many thousand years war, a global war, both a cold and a hot war. Many would like to think of this war as mainly a cold one, utilizing oppression through discrimination in social and economic forms, which often have violent effects. However, the victims, women, receive the message from the time they are small people that it is an actively physically violent war being waged upon them. They are made aware early of the guerrillas in the streets who, if they are not careful, will snatch them away and mutilate, torture, maim, or kill them. Beware the child molester. But how many girls are shocked to find there is an enemy who dwells within the confines of their protected environments, camouflaged behind the titles of father, uncle, or family friend? And how many young women are raised in homes where they see their model of adulthood, the mother, being physically abused by her husband? These girls know it is a hot war. Those not directly exposed to violence in their youth, perhaps brainwashed to believe themselves immune to involvement in the violent front lines of this battle, amazingly find themselves put there in a relationship with a man as adults. Upon reaching adulthood, all women realize the control of their bodies, their reproductive systems, is not determined by them. Many are subjected to unnecessary surgery, forced sterilization, forced pregnancy, or continuation of pregnancy. Who has this power over women's bodies? The religious, governmental, and medical institutions of the society in which they live. And these institutions are controlled by creatures with very unlike bodies, people who cannot begin to relate to such a reproductive system. Women are angry. Women who have been forced into the position of being on the front lines in the battle, in the war of sexism, have added reason for their anger. They, as frontline victims in any war, have scarred and mutilated bodies, have experienced the isolation and lack of support, the hostility of their society towards such an experience. Their eyes are especially opened in regards to the war and to the facts and effects concerning it. Their anger and fear is stirred every day as they hear about, read about, or see women who are victims of rape and battering. They are horrified at the destruction of women's bodies and women's minds and spirits, which is notable everywhere, and they are most angered to discover the lack of power and control. They have to change the situation. Those women who cannot overcome their passive conditioning, who accept their impotence and victimization outwardly through lack of a knowledgeable choice, take it as a personal defeat. They feel helpless, sterile. They often channel their anger towards themselves. Depression, the woman's disease. Depression, anger turned inward. Valium, liquor, drugs. The victimization process continues. Fortunately, many of us, whether or not exposed directly to the violence and destruction of this war, have gained a lot of knowledge about and insight into the condition. We do not love the institutions and people responsible for our victimization. We do not take on the oppressive roles of those in power and use them to oppress others. We do not want to see aggression of people upon other people rewarded. We do not identify with and refuse to participate in the perpetuation of this senseless violence. Instead, we try to teach others to recognize the tactics, both subtle and blatant, and the realities of this deadly situation. Tolstoy wrote that women have a universal acceptance and understanding of death that men only try to learn. We cannot feel sorry for men who have lost their innocent way of looking at life, as if people were immortal, as some war veterans have lost. We have always known our mortality and that of our children. We are not sorry that we are sensitive human beings and that we can identify with others who are victims. How else can we help eliminate the category of victim? We as women did not choose this war in which we are illegitimately involved. We would not choose any war. Instinctively, we know that any destruction of human beings is a challenge to the survival of us all. Until those who are commonly deemed declared and promised the position of winner on the battlefields against other individuals become aware there are no winners in struggles between people, but only in struggles in which all people enter against our common age-old enemies of disease and famine. Until there are no medals, no praise for any type of violence done to anyone. Until the concept of being a man includes the ability to be knowledgeable, sensitive, and understanding of the human condition, past and present. Until then, destructive feats of violence, abuse, and oppression of people will not cease. Those who have been active, aggressive contributors to war must not perpetuate it by continuing it wherever they happen to be. The oldest and most basic war between people must be ended. If it is not, there will soon be the war during which it will be unquestionably proven that there are no winners, no heroes. There will be no more killing for the glory of God or government or for the honor of manhood. There will be nobody left to kill. Therein lies the anger of women. And that was by Vicki Swanson Garmo, who is a former resident of Astoria and was an early volunteer for the Clatsop County Women's Crisis Service. She wrote this article for the June 1986 North Coast Times Eagle. And now, from Jennifer Weiner. Laughter is President Donald Trump's weapon of choice. Mockery is his go-to, especially where women are concerned. And other Republicans have learned well from him. They know the names to call us: clowns, a mob, angry. They know how to claim that they are the real victims, harassed at their homes, hounded out of restaurants. They know how to do what it takes to win. And when they do, they don't just claim victory, they humiliate their vanquished foes. For so many women, these past weeks have been agony, the double dismay of having been hurt, then having been mocked, our pain disbelieved and drowned out by their laughter. The world my daughters and Brett Kavanaugh will inherit is the world we inhabit now, where men get excused and women get interrogated. How much did you drink? Who drove you to the party? And where was the room where it happened? And who drove you home when it was over? What will I tell my daughters? Speak up, even if those in power do not want to listen. Speak your truth, even if men laugh. Be loud, even though power prefers girls quiet. Speak up, even if they call you strident or shrill. Don't let anyone put a hand, real or metaphorical, over your mouth. March, demonstrate, chant, shout, vote. And maybe someday you or your daughter's daughters will be the ones with the last laugh. This is an excerpt from an article, a larger article that Jennifer Weiner wrote. She is the author, most recently, of the memoir, Hungry Heart. And in closing, Oregon ballots will be mailed out this coming week and the last day for unregistered voters to register for the upcoming November 6th election is Tuesday, October 16th. This is Michael McCusker. I dedicate today's program to the memory of Eleanor Roosevelt, who was born today, October 11th, 1884. She died in 1963. She said, "Women must get into the political game and stay in it." I recommend everybody read her 1940 book, The Moral Basis of Democracy. And I'll end in much the same way I began. No Way to Paradise, a poem by Kimberly Stubbs. Chief Sealath's a reply to Christopher Columbus. Gold is a wonderful thing. Whoever owns it is lord of all he wants. With gold, it is even possible to open for souls the way to paradise. Christopher Columbus. What is gold? When the buffalo's thunder is stilled, the earth no longer drummed by mud-hard hooves. What is gold when the thirsty earth leaves no water for us to cool our mouths, hot from words, but swallows and drops to quench her own fire? What is gold when grass turns brown, when cold, cold wind blows ice through tents and houses, and there's no more buckskin, no fur to bring warmth, no wood for fire, for all the trees have died? With gold, it is even possible to open for souls the way to paradise. But I say the way is death, and gold the destroyer of life. That was by Kimberly Stubbs. And The Birds and Columbus by Ann Stafford. The journal shows that the birds of North America deserve the credit. Samuel Eliot Morison. First, far out from any shore, he thought them land birds, the Arctic tern, the reed tail, the petrel, residing in the long spaces of the sea, and believed he sailed between islands. Later, though he had determined a course due west, he turned south to follow them. The land birds, migrants in October, all crowding south, whole clouds of ducks and geese, thrushes, vireos, swallows, flashes of hummingbirds and golden plover, and nights the bobolink. He had heard somewhere that birds are good to follow, and so he did, missing by this simple turn of the wheel the Gulf Stream, relentlessly pushing northward to the reefs of Hatteras. But here, a crown of islands, a world for taking. And that was Ann Stafford, The Birds and Columbus.